This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Eastern North Carolina has been inundated with rain when a system stalled along the coast, dumping up to 22 inches of rain in some areas. The slow-moving nor'easter, combined with tropical moisture from Hurricane Joaquin, caused widespread flooding across the region earlier this week. The main impact was on North Carolina's agriculture industry. It's harvest time. Sweet potatoes, peanuts, soybeans, and tobacco are ready to be picked, so it's the worst time for strong winds and rain. After this week's storm, fields are flooded, plants have been destroyed, and some crops, like cotton, may be a total loss because they can't be harvested when the seeds are softened by rain. It's not known exactly how much damage was caused, but Governor Pat McCrory and Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler were in eastern North Carolina this week surveying the damage. Troxler said later, every major crop in the state took a hit from the recent storm. We'll continue to cover the agricultural losses as more information comes available. The National Guard moved out of eastern North Carolina this week and into South Carolina on Thursday to help them recover from record flooding. More than 500 soldiers and airmen were sent to help with public information and staff support, set up road barriers, and provide critical necessities like water. The primary mission of the Guard is to assess bridges, roads, and buildings, and assist with debris removal, road repair, and construction. During the storm, the National Guard supported emergency operations here in eastern North Carolina. From their staging area in Goldsboro, 44 members of the National Guard were dispersed to parts of Bladen, Brunswick, Carteret, Hyde, and Pamlico counties. Lieutenant Robert Morris with Force Package 1 says they supported local law enforcement and emergency response personnel.
Delivering swift water rescue personnel to go do rescue missions. They were driving around personnel to do reconnaissance of areas to determine how bad flooding was in certain areas. That was primarily down in Pamlico.
Members also assisted in vehicle recovery. National Guard troops helped out in Pamlico County, which dealt with some of the region's worst flooding. Sheriff Chris Davis says the persistent 25 to 30 mile per hour winds pushed water into low-lying areas, causing flooding typically associated with a hurricane or tropical storm.
The hardest hit areas in Pamlico County were the Hoboken and Lowland community, as well as the Florence and Hortonsville community. At one point in time, in between Hoboken and Lowland, there was about 4.5 feet of water on the road, and then there was an area down to Florence and Hortonsville area that had about 3.5 to 4 foot of water on the road.
Flooding caused two sections of road in Pamlico County to wash out, one on Kershaw Road and the other on Noose Road. That's when they called in the National Guard to assist with extrication of residents.
We had an issue in Hoboken where we had 7 people inside of a house and they actually ran out of food and water. So we had to go in and get those folks out of the house. And then we had another issue down to Hortonsville where there was actually water coming in a home and it was an elder couple and they could not get out. So we had to go down there and get them out of the house as well.
Davis says a total of 6 homes were flooded and there's been reports of several vehicles that were flooded. The official damage assessment for Pamlico County has not been released. He says no injuries were reported during the storm. It's a similar story in Beaufort County, where areas at the mouth of the Pungo River and along Pamlico River were hardest hit.
We've had some of the highest water that we've had since Hurricane Irene, and the highest water that I've ever seen here when we've had a nor'easter.
Emergency manager John Pack says a dozen homes had water in them and several businesses were flooded.
The town of Bellhaven had water going into some of the stores on Main Street. It had water across all the other streets in Bellhaven. Plus, we had a minor fuel spill, diesel fuel, and got the Coast Guard in. Spill team worked with our technician, and they were able to find the source and properly take care of the source before it became a much bigger spill.
Heavy rains and swollen creeks prompted the North Carolina Department of Transportation to close 26 roads in Beaufort County, especially in the Pamlico Beach area, where the water was several feet deep and impassable for ambulances.
Now, there were some big trucks that were able to get through, and we were able to run our fire trucks through it in order to extricate some people.
In addition to the flooding, PAC says there were intermittent power outages during the weekend, affecting anywhere from 20 to 450 people. The local fire department assisted DOT crews in clearing roads of downed trees and debris from the storm. Craven County was not spared either. Director of Emergency Services Stanley Kite says they received 12 to 14 inches of rainfall this past weekend, flooding areas that are prone to inundation during nor'easters.
The majority of it was in the Harlow community, more specifically Adams Creek Road area, Becton Road. We also had flooding out in River Bend, over in Fairfield Harbor, Bryce's Creek, in and around East Front Street in New Bern, South Front Street, Oaks Road, Glen Burnie Road in New Bern.
Kite says water did get into several crawl spaces and garages, but no homes were damaged. Only three trees were knocked down during the storm, but two of them fell on Highway 118 west of Vanceboro, prompting accidents. Kite says emergency responders had to rescue a couple of motorists who attempted to drive through flooded areas in Craven County.
We had one with a mother and her two children on a private road that slipped off the road into a canal, and their vehicle was getting submerged, but fortunately they were able to get out.
Kite says Craven County fared well during the nor'easter, with no injuries reported. Most areas in Onslow County made it through the storm with relatively minor impacts, according to Director of Emergency Services Norman Bryson. 13 homes and businesses were affected by heavy rains and storm surge.
We've seen a few houses that have had a little bit of water in them. The fortunate piece is most of those houses were designed to be secondary level homes, and the damages were really very minimal.
Three of these homes in Onslow County were considered to have minor damage, which translates into $224,000. Swansboro's figures haven't been tallied yet. Bryson says he expects several businesses in that area with minor damage. Downtown Jacksonville also received minor flooding near the New River, and areas near Sneed's Ferry were also impacted.
We had several issues of flooding in North Topsail, but most of that was where the waves actually broke through some of the dunes and got into the roadway. So there were some areas there that we saw almost a foot and a half of water standing in the road because of that.
Beach erosion from high swell is an ongoing concern on North Topsail Island. During the most recent storm, town officials estimate about $15.5 million in damages on their 11 miles of coastline.
Now, we also have state and federal personnel coming in next week to evaluate that to see what amount has actually occurred. But so there's a lot of concern there with the beach erosions. North Topsail has put in a lot of sandbags in the last couple of years trying to protect homes down in that area. And, of course, there'll be an effect over time if that sand's not able to be replaced or replenished.
Now that the flooding is going down, residents across eastern North Carolina are cleaning up debris and making necessary repairs. Just because the storm is over doesn't mean there isn't a risk of injury. Beaufort County Emergency Manager John Pack urges residents to take precautions when picking up debris.
They should be wearing gloves and double bagging that material, and they should use great caution when picking up lumber, especially treated lumber, as it may have nails or wood screws in them that could definitely put a hurting on a person.
When cleaning up your yard, you should also be on the lookout for snakes hiding in debris. Also, make sure to wear long sleeve pants and shirts, as mosquitoes will likely be a nuisance. Carteret County Public Works Department said this week that they'll be spraying and larviciding to reduce mosquito populations after this significant rainfall event. PAC says Beaufort County is preparing to respond if mosquitoes get out of hand.
Our county environmental engineers were out and placed mosquito traps out. We had them out before the storm came so that we can monitor and see if it starts growing, then they will start spraying.
More rain is expected across eastern North Carolina this weekend. National Weather Service Warning Coordination Meteorologist John Cole says he doesn't expect it will greatly impact the area.
We feel like the main bulk of rainfall will probably occur on Saturday across the area where we have categorical precipitation chances, 80% right now. We're only expecting maybe up to a half an inch of rainfall associated with this system.
Cole adds the rainfall this weekend won't impact local rivers and creeks. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The dark cloud of economic recession has a silver lining for North Carolina employees. A recent study by the Institute in Raleigh confirms that a diverse number of businesses are hiring. These career fields are vast, but they have one thing in common. They are minority-owned firms. Sarah Finch has more on this demographic shift and its impact on the economy.
We all know a recession is not a good thing, but sometimes good can come out of it. This rings true for Goodell Ward, a minority business owner and Eastern North Carolina native.
I think the recession has helped folks zero in on what their skill sets are and allow them to chase work that they can really maximize their return on profit.
His company, IMEC Group LLC, founded in Jones County, now specializes in project management, engineering, and construction services for local, state, and federal clients.
My dad and brother had a construction company, probably about a 4 or 5 man operation, and they weren't doing anything. And so my thoughts on that was, let's pursue public projects, and that's what we did. And we've basically doubled the workforce since 2008.
Inspiring stories like Ward's are becoming increasingly common, according to a recent study by a nonprofit management consulting firm in Raleigh called The Institute. The organization has focused on business and economic growth through effective business diversity for over 30 years. The Institute's founder and senior fellow Andrea Harris says their most recent report using U.S. Census Bureau data found that minority-owned businesses within our state are rebounding. Its analysis reveals that African-American-owned firms expanded their employee numbers at a higher rate than white employers' businesses.
Naturally, they have more white firms than African-American firms, but their white firms added employees at a rate of 1.7%, and black firms were adding employees by 9% over that same period of 2007 to 2012. Well, that is tremendous because we've gone through a recession during that same time.
These don't seem like normal statistics during an economic downturn. Why would hiring increase as the times got tougher? In order to find an answer, Harris worked closely with the Institute's Policy Center, which identifies current trends and analyzes demographics. According to their research, the recession prompted people to explore all their options.
I think that as people found themselves in positions where they were working fewer hours or they got laid off as corporations cut back, they had to figure out ways to sustain themselves and their families. And so a number of people went into business. And some people who were in business started to look at what other value can I bring to the marketplace? Are there opportunities for me?
Nearly 30 years ago, when the Institute was started, the government and community leaders recognized then that globalization, shifting demographics, and technology were changing the game. Business owners were expanding and diversifying their employee base, replacing traditional industries with new ones that required different skills and success strategies. Harris says she has personally seen these social and economic transformations.
Technology and transportation in particular are the two arenas that opened up a global marketplace. The other place that I think that we've seen some changes is just in how people do business. So if I am a business person and I'm going to do business with a major corporation, then it's not me just going in to meet you. I have to bid electronically.
This kind of computer automation now appears much more frequently in workplaces across North Carolina. For Kevin Thorne, founder and president of Best Diamond Packaging in Kinston, the addition of a robotic arm in their manufacturing process has greatly increased the company's efficiency. Thorne mentions it has also saved them a lot of money, and it never asks for days off. He went on to say that in order to compete on a global scale, his minority-owned business has embraced the technical side of production.
How we interact with our customers, there's a lot more online, a lot more use of barcodes and things of that nature, a lot of things that streamline the time that it takes to see how much inventory is in their entire system. A lot of technology has come along of late that has helped us provide them with better service.
While they may be selling an everyday commodity like napkins, Thorne says that every customer is important, and the business relationships he forms with clients like McDonald's and Wendy's are beyond color and race. Thorne explained it doesn't matter if you're black, white, or polka dot. Good business is about dependability, quality, responsiveness, and fairness.
Of the 7 or 8 of us in my office in management positions, at least 4 of us are African American, which makes sense in my company, but that's indicative of the fact that these folks are qualified and they're capable and they're readily available in Kinston. And, you know, I think there's more of that going on. I think there's more folks that are out there of African American descent who are getting educated, getting the skills that they need to compete, and getting an opportunity to compete.
The most recent calculations from the 2012 U.S. Census Bureau show that North Carolina is home to 184,000 minority-owned firms. In that same year, they contributed $23.5 million in economic output and created over 156,000 jobs. To help people navigate these promising waters, the Institute has a comprehensive strategy to expand and diversify North Carolina's business base. Harris adds that it is less costly to invest in the economic development of communities than it is to respond to the negative social consequences of economic isolation.
People are regaining confidence in the economy and building more relationships across lines of race and gender. You know, when people gain confidence, that's just an unquantifiable plus.
And many times, that confidence comes with business ownership, which is one of the most proven strategies to create prosperity. With this in mind, the Institute is helping employers to gain access to market opportunities and financing. Over the course of the last 10 years, they have awarded minority-owned businesses in the state between $50 to $80 million a year.
We've seen a number of changes in eastern North Carolina. While we don't have the number of major corporations, you still have the pharmaceuticals, you have the seafood and agricultural industry, you still have a need to move the goods and services. So transportation and trucking is a big thing in the east.
Other workforce transitions emerging in eastern North Carolina include construction, secondary road maintenance bids, establishing solar farms, and the expansion of healthcare providers. These and other minority-owned businesses often have a direct impact in underserved communities. Harris believes this is the silver lining aftermath of a very hard economic downturn.
Well, I think that while the downside of the recession was just the loss in net worth and the loss of jobs, I think the upshot of it was people were willing to take greater risk, and that resulted in increased numbers of businesses.
From a recession to a horizon of possibilities, our state is growing, hiring, and learning to change with the times. Engaging significant untapped segments of the population has become a business and economic imperative that will ultimately bring people together for a greater cause, prosperity across North Carolina. For Public Radio East, I'm Sarah Finch.
On October 19th, Farmville Public Library is hosting a free lecture about the Tuscarora War with Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, Dr. David Levere. He'll focus on how North Carolina's geography caused the Tuscarora War, drew it out, helped and hurt both Indian and colonists, and finally helped bring the war to a close. This week, Mac McKee spoke with Dr. Levere about his upcoming presentation.
What kind of landmass are we talking about that the Tuscarora War encompassed?
Well, the Tuscarora War started on 22nd of September, 1711, and it began with a massive attack by the Indians in kind of this area from the Pamlico River down south to the Wetok River.
Now, North Carolina's geography not only played an important role in the war itself and how it was fought, but it also affected North Carolina's economic colonial development. For instance, the lack of a deep water port and poor road system in the colony.
North Carolina probably was the poorest of the 13 colonies, or what would become the 13 colonies. And you nailed it. It had no deep water port. Down in South Carolina, Charleston had that big, wonderful port, and so it became the money-making part of Carolina. Up here on the Albemarle, you couldn't get any ships that are over 50 tons up through the sandbars and on up the river. So because of that, it remained very poor, and the lack of a deep water port is going to make it hard for North Carolina to really have a really viable economic system, which means the Indians are going to be more powerful until the Tuscarora War.
How did internal divisions affect the economic and military stances?
North Carolina was unprepared for the war and had very little means of raising an army. They just have a very divided colony, and this was a perfect time, seemingly, for the Indians to attack. The Indians of eastern North Carolina were just as divided as the European colonists. The lay of the land there, you have two kind of groups of Tuscaroras. One group, the upper Tuscaroras, those people lived along the Roanoke River, and they were closer to the settlers of the Albemarle. They're also closer to Virginia. Then you have more of the lower Tuscaroras, like I said, along the Neuse River, mainly along Contentnea Creek. Well, those are the ones that are going to attack, and they'll ally with the Core Indians and the Neuse Indians and the Bay River Indians. But the ones up to the north there, they stay out of it. As the war gets moving a few years later, many of them, their King Tom Blunt will actually go and fight on the side of the English against the Catechina Alliance.
The aftermath of the Tuscarora Wars, it seems to have two legacies. One, on the negative side, it devastated both North Carolina economically and the Tuscaroras as a tribe. Now, long term, on the positive side, North Carolina did grow as a colony, and the Tuscaroras and the overall Native American Indian population did grow to become one of the largest populations east of the Mississippi. Is that sort of a legacy of a mixed bag or partial success?
It all depends on where you're sitting and where you want to see it from. From a Catuchina Alliance point of view, the war starts out well for them with these great attacks, but they're defeated and really smashed. I mean, it doesn't take long for many of these Indian people, the Neuse Indians, the Pamlico Indians, the White Oak River Indians, who just disappear from the colonial records. And that doesn't mean they're all dead. You know, many of them went and migrated into swamps and hid out. But they're certainly not there as a people that the colony has to deal with or later on the state. Immediately after the war and for years after it, it's pretty tough on them. They're kind of out of sight, out of mind. But then you say there's a great resurgence of Indians in North Carolina during the 20th century. And so now we have pretty close to 100,000 American Indian people in North Carolina. But you're right, it does smash the power of the Indians, and it does open the way for North Carolina to expand to the Piedmont and expand south to the Cape Fear River. So it's kind of where you sit depends on, you know, how you feel about it.
Your presentation itself is coming up October 19th at the Farmville Public Library. If you want to know more, you can check out the events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
MumFest 2015 takes place in downtown New Bern this weekend. The festival attracts more than 90,000 people each year for entertainment, attractions, works by local artisans, and savory food. But the best place to see the star of the show, the chrysanthemum, is at Tryon Palace. The gardens are open this weekend free of charge. 1,500 mums will be in bloom just in time for MumFest. On this week's Garden Journal, Onslow County Horticulture Extension Agent Lisa Rayburn stops by to learn how gardeners are preparing for the festival and what else is in bloom this fall.
I'm at Tryon Palace in New Bern today, and I'm here with Frida Pyron. She's a gardener here at Tryon Palace. Frida, thank you for joining us today.
Welcome.
The palace was originally completed in 1770 and rebuilt in 1959. Can you give us a brief introduction to the palace and its history?
Well, the palace itself is a reproduction. This is someone's interpretation of what a formal garden in the 1770s would have been. We're in the Latham Garden, which is an English interpretation of a French parterre garden. We also have gardens that are Victorian era. We have the hay house, which is a dirt swept yard, which is 1835. We have the Stoney and the Jones, which are early 1900 New Bern gardens. And some of the plants we grow would have been found in gardens in those time periods, not necessarily the species. We have to try to find something that likes to live in New Bern, which is hot and sometimes too dry and sometimes too wet.
The palace has over 16 acres of gardens. Which is your favorite garden?
That depends on the time of the year. Sometimes the Stoney. That's one of the early 1900 New Bern gardens.
As a gardener here, what does your typical day look like?
We come in the morning and we take care of the seed trays and the seedlings in the greenhouse. You have to water those first thing in the morning. Take care of the nursery yard. The gardeners are going to their areas and cleaning up. Like right now, you have to clean up leaves every day, taking down some of the perennials and things that are coming to the end of their lifespan. So they're starting on the fall cleanup.
So you were telling us on the way in that you guys were anticipating a truck this morning. What were you guys getting in today?
We got in 1,500 mums, and that's what the guys are doing right now. And we also have some volunteers helping place the mums. We don't plant them anymore. We place them in the hedges, keep them in other places. We mound them up with pine straw, which is something we learned that Biltmore does. So steal other people's good ideas.
As all gardeners do. All gardens change with the seasons. What would you encourage visitors to come see now?
The mums will be showing more color in a week or so. Some of them are just starting to break. there's something blooming here all the time. Like we have Petrania that's getting ready to bloom, and we're going to have some Forsythia sage, which is a really spectacular yellow sage. Things like Mystic Spire sage are blooming now. We still have some summer annuals that are just hanging on a little bit. Oh, and which you could smell when you came in was the osmanthus. And we have those in several locations, so you can smell that throughout the site.
Frida, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your gardens with us.
Thank you.
Mumfest will be held on October 10th and 11th at Tryon Palace in New Bern. There will also be a Fall Heritage Plant Sale October 9th and 10th here in the gardens at Tryon Palace. For more information about these two events, check out the website tryonpalace.org.